this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Most hunger strikers are still incarcerated, many in solitary-like conditions. Gang validation is still being used to deny people parole. Folks are living with the trauma of being in the shoe for that long. That doesn't just go away.
The Strike is a documentary about solitary confinement in the California prison system, prison segregation, and the prisoners' strikes of 2011 and 2013. We'll hear from its co-director, Lucas Gilkey.
Obviously, this is a candidate that has shown through his life racist behavior coming even from his father.
Ricardo Ortiz discusses the racist attacks on Puerto Ricans at Trump's rally at New York City's Madison Square Garden.
Whether Trump or Harris wins this month, American workers must steel themselves to fight either and both capitalist parties, their imperialist agendas, and their use of the instruments of state power.
And as this presidential election season wound to a close, the mudslinging from both major capitalist parties, Republican and Democratic, grew in intensity. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Lucas Gilkey is the co-director of The Strike, a documentary about solitary confinement in the California prison system, prison segregation, and the prisoner strikes of 2011 and 2013. He recently spoke to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio.
Can you talk a little bit about the security housing units, commonly known as the SHU, in the California prison system? What are they? How do you get put in it? And how do you get out?
Thank you so much, JR, for having me on. It's an honor. Really excited to be sharing about our documentary, The Strike, today. The security housing unit was the form of long-term solitary confinement in the California state prison system. And I should say it is the form of long-term solitary confinement in the California state prison system. And there historically have been four major units at Pelican Bay, Corcoran, Tehachapi, and New Folsom, which are windowless concrete cells built to hold people in solitary indefinitely, and folks were held there for decades, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, the longest in California being Hugo Pinnell at 44 years. There are basically two ways people could get put in the security housing unit or the SHU. One was for breaking a prison rule. You'd get a set term, whether that's a number of months or up to 5 years. There was an entirely parallel way that people were sent to the SHU, which was if you received a label on yourself, basically an association of a prison gang. If you were labeled as an associate of a prison gang, you could be put in the security housing unit indefinitely. And as we know from a bunch of great reporting, including yourself, JR, covering the hunger strikes, the system of prison gang validation can be incredibly racist, with Black prisoners being targeted for having Black political literature, such as works that reference George Jackson, Latino prisoners having imagery of Mayan or Aztec imagery from their culture would also be validated as a member of a prison gang. These are all the conditions that led up to the major hunger strikes of 2011 and 2013.
Before we talk about the prison strikes of 2011 and 2013, can you talk about this non-hostility pact that you talked about in your documentary, The Strike? And why was it a historic feat? Why was it such a phenomenal thing that needed to be documented?
This is a really important point. The California prison system is incredibly racially segregated. As you talk to folks who have spent time there, the minute you get off the bus, you're asked which group you're a part of, and segregated into that group. And this is an issue that has gone all the way to the United States Supreme Court, how segregated the California state prison system is. And so over the many decades of this racial segregation, there has been hostility and animosity between various groups. And of course, who is in prison? It's young men, you know, coming from all around the state, often from conditions of poverty, trauma. into this environment. And so in the early 2000s, there were historical animosities that, you know, were multi-generational in many ways. And so what happened around the time of the hunger strikes is folks came together across those racial divides and started to see their common humanity and their common struggle against a common oppressor. And it happened in the solitary confinement unit of Pelican Bay, in the short corridor, where leaders were segregated, or those who had influence were segregated. And, you know, if you talk to guys who were there, the security housing unit has pods of 8 cells in a pod, kind of this honeycomb structure. And you would have 2 black prisoners, 2 white prisoners, 2 northern Mexicans, which is Mexican Americans generally from Northern California, and 2 southern Mexicans, which is Mexican Americans from Northern California. And the idea was, oh, they have animosity, they won't talk to each other. But the plan backfired, and folks did start talking to each other, and a lot of political consciousness raising started happening. Folks were reading, folks were discussing, you know, as much as they could, because this is solitary confinement. It's very difficult to get beyond that pot of 8, but the mail was actually really important, and newsletters and newspapers such as SF Bayview, California Prison Focus. A lot of consciousness was raising, and this culminated in the agreement to end hostilities, which is a historic document that was signed by this collective in 2012. And it says, we are no longer going to fight amongst each other. We are going to unite in collective action in this nonviolent hunger strike against the system that is oppressing all of us and keeping us separated. And it was such a historic moment that it led to peace work also being done on the streets of Los Angeles and across the state. So a lot can be attributed to the historical significance of this document.
What was the political setting like when the security housing units were politically created in United States legislature? Like, what was going on? Who were some of the politicians pushing it? And can you talk a little bit about the conception of Pelican Bay? What is Pelican Bay for those that don't know? And how does it play into this scenario, particularly as you documented in your documentary, The Strike?
So the rise of mass solitary confinement happened in parallel with the rise of mass incarceration, which really happened throughout the country in the 1980s. This is also happening in the aftermath of the civil rights, black power, and other social movements of the 60s and 70s, where we see just widespread like control and repression against populations, especially working class black and brown populations. Legislators in California started passing a lot of laws that criminalized a lot of people. And if you look at a graph of the population of the California state prison system, it just starts shooting upward. And CDCR basically has a blank check to build a ton of prisons. Ruthie Gilmore quotes a government document saying this is one of the largest prison building programs in world history. The capstone project of the California prison building boom is Pelican Bay. It's a giant concrete fortress, a supermax prison, nestled in the redwood forest on the border of Oregon in the most remote part of the state, incarcerating mostly people from Los Angeles. And as we show in the film, we have footage of the opening dedication of Pelican Bay with Governor George Duke Majan, who was part of sort of this right-wing era, Ronald Reagan era, christening the prison. And there's a pastor that, you know, it's very Orwellian, talks about, we're building this prison not out of fear, but out of love for humanity. So it's pretty wild. And this is the prison that ultimately would incarcerate people in windowless solitary confinement for decades.
Why is this important to look at for people outside of California? Why should people outside of California be concerned about the security housing units, isolation, as well as Pelican Bay and what's going on in the California prison system?
Pelican Bay, I believe, was the 3rd supermax prison in the United States. So it was in the early part of this wave of incredible repression through incarceration. We have supermax prisons across the country now. There's over 60, I believe. Guantanamo Bay is a supermax prison. They're now building supermax prisons in El Salvador in a big way. So this idea of the supermax is not limited to California. It's all over the world. And what's so important about this story is it's about resistance to this incredible form of repression from the inside. you know, in a way that nobody thought was possible. Even the folks that called for the hunger strike, no one thought it would catch fire the way it did. No one thought it would spread and ultimately be as successful as it was. I mean, it's really a universal story, and it is about the collective struggle. It is about how do people come together in impossible conditions to organize and change the material conditions, which is relevant to every human on Earth. And I think we need more stories like that. And so it's definitely not limited to California. I think within specific stories, you can find things that resonate universally with people all over the world.
What made you and your partner come together to create this documentary? What was the impetus for you personally?
I have been following the hunger strikes since they were happening in 2011 and 2013. And I was actually volunteering to make social media videos to raise awareness about what was happening at the time. And I just met incredible individuals. I met a lot of family members who are organizing on behalf of their loved ones inside to become their voices on the outside, who were becoming politically active for the first time in their lives. A lot of amazing organizers, attorneys, and who were just experiencing what was a transformative movement. And I knew at that time, like, this deserves to be a documentary, but I didn't quite know how to tell it. Jobo Munoz and I met as students at the grad school at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and we formed a creative partnership there. And, you know, it takes a lot of time, energy, resources, obstacles to create a feature-length documentary. But when we put our two skill sets together, we were able to make it happen.
Earlier in the interview, you talked a little bit about the racial segregation as historic in the California prison system, but you were able to get prisoners across racial lines that have a lot of influence in the prison system. Can you talk a little bit about that, and what was that process like, gaining the trust of white prisoners, of black prisoners, of Mexican prisoners? What was that like, and putting that in one film, how did they receive that?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so like I have been connected with folks connected to this movement for a long time. And like I said, I met a lot of family members at first who are organizing and filmed a ton with them, spent a lot of time. Dolores Canales is featured in the film and others. And so many years later, when the hunger strikes were over and when the class action settlement that was connected to the hunger strikes had occurred, you know, we wanted to film them, but we can't really film them when they're in prison, even if they're in general population. But eventually, after many years, some of them started getting released in various ways. And because of my pre-existing relationships, pre-existing trust, I was able to connect and just start, you know, some folks we filmed on their release day. Paul Redd, RIP, was released in 2020 during the pandemic. Incredible day. And we filmed with his family as he stepped out of the prison gates for the first time in decades. And then I think, you know, the story of the hunger strike, the story of the agreement and to end hostilities is the story of collective solidarity across racial differences. And so I think, you know, that's the story we want to tell. And that's the story of why people joined this movement and participated in this movement. And so I think, you know, the trust was there. This is a story we all wanted to tell and that the world needs to know. Not everyone knows each other, though. And I will say we had a screening earlier this year at a film festival. And a lot of folks in the film have met each other, but not everyone. And a couple folks were meeting each other for the first time on stage, you know, and didn't know each other, had participated, had been incarcerated in Pelican Bay, had participated in the hunger strikes together. And it was a really powerful moment to witness them shaking hands, you know, and acknowledging that they had each played a role in this. So that's all been very positive.
Do you feel like the hunger strikes accomplished their goals?
That's a great question. I think it's a victory, but I think it's a bittersweet victory. I think it's important to acknowledge that material change has happened, and that wouldn't have happened if it not for the hunger strikes. So people were being held indefinitely in solitary confinement for decades. It is now limited to 5 years, and people can no longer be put in solitary for having alleged gang association. The UN says solitary for more than 15 days is torture. So there is still a strong movement to limit it to 15 days. 5 years is still very long. Also, most hunger strikers are still incarcerated, many in solitary-like conditions. Gang validation is still being used to deny people parole. Folks are living with the trauma of being in the SHU for that long. That doesn't just go away. So I think it's complex, but I think it's important to acknowledge the wins that were made and, you know, that there's a lot of ongoing struggles.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lucas Gilkey. He is one of two directors of the phenomenal new documentary, The Strike, which insightfully looks at solitary confinement in the California prison system, as well as the prisoner strikes of 2011 and 2013. Where can people get more information inside the Bay Area, as well as people outside the Bay Area?
We encourage folks to check out our website and our Instagram. It's The Strike Film for both of them. That's thestrikefilm.com. It has our trailer, upcoming screenings. The Instagram is also The Strike Film, thestrikefilm.com. And we also want to let folks who are listening know that we will be broadcast on PBS in the spring of 2025. So early next year, we'll be on Independent Lens, which means we'll be broadcast in households across the country as well as prisons across the country.
That was filmmaker Lucas Gilkey speaking to Block Report Radio's J.R. Valray. Gilkey is the co-director of the documentary The Strike, which will be featured nationally on PBS in February.
Welcome to America. Be careful how you roll. It's a massacre. Don't be careful how you roll. Be careful how you move. Welcome to America. Be careful how you roll. Regardless what the context is, Rocket Harden, 13 stars, 13 bars, God talking, beg your pardon, burn the sage, smudge the haters off them. I ain't standing for no anthems, and I'm unapologetically the blackest rapper rapping, yes, the melanin is popping. And what is probably the most anti-black trap, I figure that's an understatement. Watch these racists in high places, hate on greatness when your savior's rocking. J. Edgar Hoover watching, that's how they do the prophets. Try to counter intelligence, I might call Alice these Hoover projects. Getting shooters optics, raise their conscience when they aim it. We ain't losing if they choose to pop it. This ain't rage's logic, I mean she's such a problem. Genocide, pogroms, menticide, psyopic. Germs, biologic, corporate patents on the virus. A lot of pretty liars, legislative lynch mobbers. Welcome to America. Be careful how you roll. It's a massacre. Be careful how you move. Welcome to America. Be careful how you roll. It's a massacre. See, I come full court press. This ain't a rap tour. On to the next. You can clap or show respect. Encore, bonjour, French consort to a headboard. Cause every man want the best girl for bar. Been off the chain since my mama, then mama, then mama said, get him rolling with Tuckman. Put the muzzle in his mouth and bust it. I don't argue with nobody that Harriet would have had to shoot. Do the math, call it class, get I am the truth. Survived 300 years of chattel, battle, black codes, reconstruction overthrown. 100 years of lynching, not to mention Jim Crow, Bill Clinton crime bill, prison system, crack epidemic, rap gimmicks, whack lyrics, cap spitters, fact dismisses, a host of masses manufacturing. I'm trying to paint the picture, give you a lyrical visual, how these monsters falsified your conscience. Oh, you gotta watch them. Welcome to America. Be careful how you roll. It's a massacre. Be careful how you move.
That was Wise Intelligent, America. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Next, we hear from Puerto Rican labor researcher Ricardo Ortiz, who spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the racist attacks on Puerto Ricans at Trump's rally at New York City's Madison Square Garden.
So, Ricardo, why don't you talk about what happened at that rally? What was that all about, that they had this comedian, so-called comedian there, making these kind of statements?
Well, that's a part of the whole overall campaign of Donald Trump of attacking minorities, even people that do not agree with his politics. Obviously, this is a candidate that has shown through his life racist behavior coming even from his father. You know, we all know that his father was sued many times in New York City by African-American and other minorities about tenants' rights in his properties. This is, so it comes from there. And we all know about Donald Trump campaigned in the 80s against those five black and Hispanic youth that were arrested and framed in the case of a rape of a woman at Central Park. He was demanding the death penalty for these guys that eventually proved to be innocent of all these charges. Donald Trump is appealing in this election to the most backward and reactionary segments of American society. So that rally, organizers, they brought this comedian that make all these comments against Puerto Rico and also against Latinos. But this hasn't stopped there, I want to say. I mean, just yesterday or the day before yesterday, he made some comments that are degrading toward women.
And, of course, he went down to Puerto Rico and threw paper towels at people. What happened in that hurricane, the aftermath, and what happened to the people of Puerto Rico during that time?
Sure. As you well know, the hurricane was a total catastrophe for, the people of Puerto Rico and in many Caribbean islands. So the catastrophe that happened in Puerto Rico was overwhelmed him. Finally, he was convinced by his advisors that it would be good publicity if he would fly there to, take advantage of the situation. And he did so after 2 weeks of the tragedy striking upon the Puerto Rican people. And once he was there, when he arrived in San Juan, he made, demeaning comments like, Katrina was worse than him, than this, was not as Katrina. And then he was taken to a community center where people were desperate. And, he grabbed some a paper towel and start, throwing it at people with a total disregard of, any respect. And definitely that caused a very angry reaction from the Puerto Rican people. And while he was president also, Congress approved some packages of aid, and he withheld as much as he could to those funds. It has been discovered now that, this information is coming, that he did that.
And candidate Vice President Kamala Harris went to a Puerto Rican restaurant and said, on the same day that happened, and said that what she wanted to do in Puerto Rico was to have more private-public partnerships for business people in Puerto Rico. Maybe you can talk, Puerto Rico has been a colony of the United States, and hasn't privatization of Puerto Rico created this terrible situation for the working people of Puerto Rico?
Well, I can tell you some examples about that. You're absolutely right in the historical context, and particularly in the last 30 years, many so-called PPPs have implemented in Puerto Rico that have caused distress and disgrace for the Puerto Rican people. And I'll give you a more recent example. With the arrival of the Oversight Control Board, Fiscal Control Board, that actually President Obama signed into effect, also came the demand of doing some PPPs. And one of these PPPs is in the energy sector, that they privatized the public utility energy corporation and gave it to a conglomerate made of an American company and a Canadian company, Luma and Genera. And ever since they have done that, there are blackouts almost every day or every week for days. So that's one example. People are really frustrated with the situation with Luma and Genera. And also, one example that has affected the people of Puerto Rico dramatically Puerto Rico had a local healthcare system, you know, that had dispensaries through and hospitals throughout the island. And, you know, this pro-statehood governor called Pedro Rosselló, he won the elections in 1992. And immediately he initiated a process of privatization of the whole public healthcare system. And, insurance companies from New England came and took over these hospitals. And it created a chaos. People no longer could have access to it. These companies closed dispensaries and put hospitals in situations that they could not have, you know, give effective service like it used to be before. And now, I mean, as we speak, people in Puerto Rico are talking about that the whole system is a crisis in the medical public system, because it has been practically given to these corporations based in the United States. And this has provoked an exodus of nurses, doctors, and healthcare professionals. Now, the Orlando Kissimmee metropolitan area is packed with, professionals from Puerto Rico that have been affected by these public and private partnerships. So it is a fraud what Kamala Harris is saying. And I want to say about the healthcare system being privatized. The head of the SEIU at that time, Andrew Stern.
Oh, John Sweeney. That was John Sweeney.
Andy Stern flew to Puerto Rico. Sweeney was the president of the FL-CIO at that time, before Rosselló was sworn into the governorship. Andy Stern was the president of SEIU, and he flew to Puerto Rico to support the privatization of the healthcare system. And he used as an excuse that, everybody that is indigent or has no resources will be able to be taken care of. Actually, I want to say that those workers that are under the SEIU being organized in Puerto Rico, they are facing the consequences of what their leaders supported over there, what Andy Stern support.
And this privatization has brought Humana and these private insurance companies to Puerto Rico, who run Puerto Rico now, the health system, and SEIU members are in Puerto Rico working at these privatized hospitals. So what have been the ramifications of Trump's rally at Madison Square Gardens? Do you think it was a fascist rally? There's a debate about that. And what has been the effect in the Puerto Rican community in this country and in Puerto Rico?
So talking about the rally, definitely many people say it was a Nazi rally, a fascistic rally, a racist rally. It could be all three combined for what, you know, has been expressed. Definitely those insults that this comedian made have had a reaction throughout the Puerto Rican communities in the United States and in the island of Puerto Rico. Many celebrities, even Republican politicians from, you know, Hispanic ancestry has separate themselves, take distance from the comments. And, it certainly has raised a backlash against against those insults. It is a fact. And, but the problem is not for the Puerto Rican people alone. I mean, Trump has demonstrated on and on his racist behavior against immigrants, calling Mexicans bad hombres, insulting Salvadorian immigrants, He said that Haitian immigrants were eating cats and dogs, pets in Ohio, which it turned out to be a lie. Trump represents the worst aspect of, the capitalist system in the United States.
And the history of Puerto Rico, the United States, when they invaded Puerto Rico, what was the role of the AFL under Gompers?
They came in 1898. The American Spanish Civil War took place 1898, and the American military landed on the 25th of July, 1898. Well, the AFL under Sam Gompers, they established a first relationship because the leadership of the nascent trade union movement in Puerto Rico, Santiago Iglesias Pantin, went to the United States and looked for Gompers and established a conversation where he cemented an alliance with Gompers. I mean, it's fair to say that at first, Gompers was not even interested in this affair, but he was convinced by this reformist leadership. And the AFL named Santiago Iglesias as their representative, not only in Puerto Rico. Many people don't know that in Cuba, the AFL also established trade unions, curiously. So Santiago Iglesias Pantin became the representative of the AFL in Cuba and in Puerto Rico. You know, so that was the grip of Yankee imperialism. It is funny because they start having a conflicting relationship because that Puerto Rican group was interested in establishing a political party, and they did, participating in elections, which, Gompers did not agree with that model. But obviously, the intent of Gompers and the AFL was supporting American foreign policy throughout the Caribbean region.
That was labor researcher Ricardo Ortiz speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Wow. I'm trying to feel something tangible in this life. Cause sometimes it seems unmanageable with the strife. I'm still trying to live right, raise my kid right. I know I've done a lot wrong, but damn sure I did right. Last night I did right, way past midnight. My morals and sense fight used to be a grim sight. Tell me, who's more real than four films? Write the score to our people's ordeal. Razor sharp with the cut of a sawmill. Never saw a mill, but I saw a mill killed over some raw krills. I live with a poor spill, more blood than any war will. This ain't Smallville, freedom's way beyond a tall hill. Get for sure kill, can't call the cops. 911 still the most serious joke for real. This is the other side of hell. This is the most finest cell. This is where you don't break that shell. You won't shake that spell. You don't find that well. Well, your soul becomes for sale. Spirit becomes retail.
What would I do if I could suddenly be and know once again?
So I dedicate my life to a mission of forward action. Revolution shun my want, have no choice but to make it happen. I step up my faction, go over disciplines of additions, subtractions, ciphers and fractions, ammunitions and rations. In the tradition of the Jacksons, Solidar, brother to Manchild, from Jonathan to George, forge a bond with the Lord. Use my tongue as a sword, take the young who are bored, ignored. Find thoughts unexplored, so the wind becomes state ward. I'm evidence of the fifth element in hip hop, most forget it to a detriment. But I'm rapping for the betterment of every hood resonant, keeping it more relevant than tsunamis hitting your settlement. Or a hurricane beyond any calculated measurement. Most are hesitant, so they speak the same rhetoric as I speak of artificial disasters caused by this government. They can block my distribution, but they won't pocket my publishing.
What would I... That was Feel Something by The Welfare Poets. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Next, we share an editorial from Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke on the Trump Madison Square Garden rally.
As this presidential election season winds to a close, the mudslinging from both major capitalist parties, Republican and Democratic, has grown in intensity. Trump's Republicans double down on their rhetoric against so-called illegal immigration, high crime, high inflation, and the threat of Marxist, communist, and fascist Democrats. Meanwhile, the Democrat power brokers, after a highly controlled primary season was staged to hand the nomination again to Joe Biden, called an audible when they were forced to confront the obvious unsuitability of Biden to run against Trump following their single televised debate this past June. With Vice President Kamala Harris installed as the Democratic nominee, Democratic rhetoric has relentlessly cast Trump as a would-be authoritarian dictator, as well as a Nazi, a fascist, and the American Hitler. Indeed, Trump's large rally, 20,000 plus, with many thousands unable to enter, at Madison Square Gardens in Manhattan, Sunday, October 27th, drew immediate comparisons to an historic rally held there in 1939 by the German-American Bund to celebrate the rise and consolidation of Hitler's Nazi regime in Germany. A large counter-protest called by the then Revolutionary Socialist Workers' Party occurred at the time, but that has gotten little mention. This willful conflation of the Trump-led Republican Party with fascism and National Socialism is meant to scare Americans into believing that the Democrats remain the only viable political party that can prevent a Trump-Nazi takeover. This depends on the deliberate confusion of what fascism is and its current viability here in the U.S. Here I draw from the writings of Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky, who observed the rise of fascism in its embryonic form in Italy beginning in 1920, that resulted in Mussolini's fascists forming a coalition government in 1922, where they began the consolidation of power over the ensuing months. Even more important were Trotsky's writings on the growing danger in Germany in the 30s. He observed that fascists are paramilitary gangs whose purpose is the destruction of the workers' movement and carrying out racial and ethnic terror. Here in the U.S., where black oppression is integral to capitalist class rule, homegrown fascism is embodied in the KKK, Nazis, and other white supremacist and alt-right and nativist groups. In addition to targeting black people with lynch mob terror, the KKK and other fascists have mobilized against trade union organizing, as well as immigrants, Jews, Asians, and other oppressed sectors. Historically, mass fascist movements are extra-parliamentary mobilizations of the enraged petty bourgeoisie, lumpen proletariat, and even a section of backward workers who've been ruined by capitalist economic crisis and then embrace murderous right-wing nationalism. They are not congressional party caucuses. The capitalist rulers hold the fascist shock troops in reserve so they can be unleashed at times of social crisis against any prospect of revolutionary struggle by the working class. Parliamentary party caucuses are one of the ways capitalists converse and negotiate their terms of rule. Trotsky wrote in January 1932, quote, "At the moment that the normal police and military resources of the bourgeois dictatorship, together with their parliamentary screens, no longer suffice to hold society in a state of equilibrium, the turn of the fascist regime arrives," end quote. The defeat of revolutionary struggles by the workers in Germany in 1819 and 1923 was a precursor to the rise of Nazism. This, combined with economic devastation and national humiliation resulting from the defeat of German imperialism in World War I, enabled the Nazis to become a mass movement by the early 30s. The Nazis then systematically terrorized all socialist and working class organizations in Germany. Many German workers, whether communist, social democrat, or simply proud unionist, wanted to fight Hitler's seizure of power in 1933 after the staged Reichstag fire. These workers were betrayed by their leadership, not least by the German Communist Party's failure to fight for working class rule. This set the stage for world war against other imperialist powers, the genocidal murder of some 11 million in the camps, including 6 million Jews, and the wholesale attempt to destroy the Soviet Union, the by then deformed but still viable and salvageable home of the October Revolution. The audio segment that follows is American liberal radical muckraking journalist Glenn Greenwald's analysis of the content and social makeup of the rally crowd, along with his conclusion that Trump's MSG rally was consistent with a strain of conservative rightist populism that has often sought a home in the Republican Party in the hopes of achieving political supremacy.
It certainly is not new that the corporate media and their Democratic allies have been comparing Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler and his movement, which constitutes roughly 50% of the country, and his supporters to members of the Nazi Party. That has been a very common theme ever since Trump descended on that elevator in 2015 and then began to be a viable candidate in the polls. What has changed, however, is that this theme has now become the central attack on Donald Trump, the central campaign narrative of the Kamala Harris campaign, starting about a week ago when they rejuvenated what was not a new story, but rather an old story, namely that an anti-Trump general, who was Trump's chief of staff and then got fired, John Kelly, said to Bob Woodward that Trump had suggested that he wanted generals similar to the ones that Hitler had, that he had expressed certain kinds of admiration for Adolf Hitler. Now, you would think if that really had happened, John Kelly would have denounced that right at that moment. He would have gone to the media and said, I have something extremely alarming to tell you. The President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, the person in charge of the nuclear codes, has been expressing admiration for Adolf Hitler and saying that there are certain things that Hitler and the Nazis did that he admires and would like to replicate. You wouldn't think that somebody would hold on to that secret for years, only to have it then rejuvenated just a few days before the election. But ever since that happened, it became apparent that that was going to be the closing argument, basically, of Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party and their loyal allies in the media. Not, here's what we plan to do for you to make your lives better if Kamala wins. Not, here are the policies of Donald Trump that he instituted during his first term that we oppose and think were detrimental to your lives. They're looking at the polling data that shows Americans overwhelmingly believe that America is on the wrong track, that they were doing better under the Trump presidency. There's obviously a lot of panic within the Democratic Party and the Kamala Harris campaign that thought they were going to ride to a fairly easy victory over Donald Trump this year. They still very well may win. The polls are close, but certainly there's a lot of panic within the Democratic Party. And as a result, they have clearly decided to make front and center this narrative that Donald Trump is essentially the new Adolf Hitler, that he's planning to build camps and send dissidents and critics in the media to those camps. People like AOC and all sorts of liberal pundits and Joy Behar have openly talked about the camps that they expect to be put into. And in advance of this rally that Donald Trump was planning to have at Madison Square Garden, they were talking as if Madison Square Garden was some sort of abandoned, useless, closed for decades forum that had only last been used in the late 1930s for Nazi sympathizers in the United States to come and hold a anti-Semitic rally that in part was designed to protest the American entrance into World War II, instead of an extremely common venue that people in New York go to all the time, that all sorts of presidential candidates have used regularly over many decades in order to hold rallies there. The minute Trump announced that he was having a rally there, they immediately began equating it with the neo-Nazi rally in the late 1930s in the United States at Madison Square Garden. And once the rally took place, before it was even over, the media essentially started accusing Trump of having held a neo-Nazi rally. Some of the media narrative is so deranged, it's so unhinged that it's almost impossible to believe. Here from the Washington Post today, quote, Another Night at the Garden, how Trump's rally echoed one in 1939. The Trump's campaign's rally in New York mirrored one in the 1930s that was openly supportive of Adolf Hitler. Now, you may think, as I think we did when we first saw this, that this was on the opinion page. This was an op-ed column by one of their columnists who's super angry that the paper chose not to endorse Kamala Harris as though that's the real function of the Washington Post. But no, it's not. It's an actual news article. It's in the news section. It's by people whom the Washington Post call reporters. And this is part of what they wrote. Quote, Madison Square Garden, as speakers at Donald Trump's Sunday night rally in the arena were eager to remind the audience, is one of the most famous venues in the world. It's where two professional sports teams play and is a mandatory stop for tours of best-selling performers, in part because it's trivially easy to tap into the millions of people that live in the New York City area. They're saying it's trivially easy to fill up Madison Square Garden. That's in order to justify the fact that Trump not only filled it up in a city and in a country and in a state that's supposed to be vehemently opposed to him, but he filled it up and then had thousands, if not tens of thousands of people waiting outside to get in. The article goes on, quote, it literally sits on top of a train station that has lines running through the city out to Long Island and over to New Jersey. In one sense, it's good that the Trump rally fell into the familiar patterns of commercialism and tourism that the Garden reinforces. It meant that while there were protesters outside and intermingled with the hundreds of Trump supporters who were leaving or had not gotten inside, the temperature was low. But it also suggested that what was underway in the arena wasn't exceptional, that it was just another evening with another niche event. But except for one similar event on a prior evening, meaning the Nazi event in 1939, the Trump event was quite exceptional indeed, except for that one similar event. The Post news article goes on, quote, on February 20th, 1939, an earlier iteration of Madison Square Garden hosted a political rally that bore some striking similarities to Trump's. Organized by a group called the German-American Bund, the event was ostensibly a celebration of George Washington's 207th birthday. In reality, it was a celebration of the ascent of Germany's Third Reich and an excoriation of the purported nefarious influence of Jewish people in the United States. Just, I want you to note that this is what the Washington Post is saying was the rally that had enormous amounts in common with the rally that Donald Trump held on Sunday, namely that it was designed to be anti-Semitic, to lament the excessive influence of Jewish Americans in American society, to spread the Nazi ideology of white supremacy. The Post news article goes on, quote, speakers in 1939 lamented government spending, rallied against Marxism, and complained about how their information, negative to their allies, was, quote, played up and twisted to fan the flames of hate in the hearts of Americans by the news media. All right, if that's all that's required to qualify as a neo-Nazi rally, namely lamenting government spending, railing against Marxism, and complaining about how information negative to their allies was played up and twisted to flame the fans of hate in the hearts of Americans by the news media, that's essentially every Republican rally over the last many decades. That's pretty much every Ronald Reagan rally that ever existed, railing against government spending, denouncing communism and Marxism, and complaining that the media purposely sides with their allies. I mean, that's really just basic populist politics, not exactly the hallmarks of a neo-Nazi rally. But the Post went on, quote, similar arguments were raised at Trump's rally as well. Quote, free America, the crowd chanted in 1939, while Trump's speakers pledged that he would, quote, save America, with the 2024 crowd chanting USA. Oh my God, this crowd chanted, quote, save America and chanted USA. These are basically Nazis. I mean, they were saying the United States is not going well. We need a change of party rule in order to, quote, save America. And then they chanted USA. And the Washington Post is using this as primary evidence of the neo-Nazi tenor of the rally in Madison Square Garden yesterday and its similarities to the 1939 rally. It goes on, quote, "The Bund managed tens of thousands of members. Trump has tens of millions. Bund leader Fritz Kuhn, who called Washington the, quote, first fascist, meaning it is praise, delivered with a brief interruption the final speech of the evening at the 1939 rally. From the outside, sure, the rally looked like another rock concert. From the inside, Fritz Kuhn would certainly have recognized what he saw." I want you to just stop and think about that for a minute. This is a news article in the Washington Post overtly claiming that Madison Square Garden has never seen a rally like the one Trump held yesterday, except for one other time in American history, which is 1939 when neo-Nazis gathered. And in order to draw the comparison between the Trump rally yesterday and the neo-Nazis in 1939, notice how they have to basically exclude all of the defining features of what made Nazis Nazis. A celebration of white supremacy, extreme hatred against Jews and other non-white people, an attempt to turn the United States into a haven of nothing but white people. Instead, they have to focus on very banal aspects of the rally, like, hey, that also had a lot of people there. It was also held at Madison Square Garden. They also chanted. They railed against government spending, too. They said Marxism was bad. These are the most banal, pervasive attributes at Democratic and Republican rallies alike over many decades. If you actually look at the rally, of course, it bore no resemblance to anything that was actually a neo-Nazi rally. In fact, the actual Nazis in 1939 would have looked at the Trump rally with hatred and contempt and disgust because of who composed the audience and who was actually speaking and what they were saying. But this is the how far the media is willing to go before elections. We've seen it so many times. They're willing to lie like they did in 2020. They're willing to create false scandals like they did in 2016 with Trump-Russia conspiracies to help the Democrats beat Trump, and now they're just simply publishing everyday claims that Donald Trump, whom they've known for years, for decades, whom they've written about with admiration for decades, suddenly is the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler.
That was journalist Glenn Greenwald speaking on his System Update podcast, number 359, from October 28th of this year. In contrast to Germany in the 1930s, the U.S. is not a defeated imperialist country, but is rather the world's biggest imperialist power. Nor does the U.S. ruling class currently face a serious challenge from the working class at home. Trump is a racist, sexist bigot, but he is not a fascist. He came to power within the framework of the bourgeois electoral system in 2016, not through the mobilization of a fascist mass movement. He aims to do the same in 2024. When leftist groups like the Revolutionary Communist Party call his regime fascist, it is to prettify U.S. bourgeois democracy and to justify unifying with so-called progressive forces in the capitalist Democratic Party. To characterize all manner of reactionary right-wing forces as fascist serves to disorient and politically disarm the struggle against the genuine Nazis and other race terrorists who have been emboldened by Trump's win. Whether Trump or Harris wins this month, American workers must steel themselves to fight either and both capitalist parties, their imperialist agendas, and their use of the instruments of state power. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke in Washington.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from J.R. Valray, Steve Zeltzer, and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.